Welcome to the third episode of the third season, Red Meridian, produced by and recorded at Lund Observatory in Sweden. Crossing our local meridian today, we have our own exoplanet specialist, Judith Korth, who recently moved to Lund to start a postdoc position here. Later in the episode, we'll also bring you some cosmic curiosities. This is the part of the show where you can hear about some ideas, event, or trivia from astronomic history. Yes, history has become legend, and legend has become myth, and some things that should not have been forgotten will now be rediscovered in our cosmic curiosities. But first, this.
Interplanetary fundamental
habitability.
The near infrared.
Near Earth asteroids.
Dynamical evolution.
Visible light.
Radio. The meridian.
Telescope.
Dark energy.
Exoplanets. The meridian.
The universe.
The Meridian.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, Rebecca.
I'm excited to get to talk to you again.
Yeah, me too.
Nice. So, what have you brought to me today?
I've got some news.
Oh, news?
Yeah, so telescope news.
Sure.
So,
sure.
I've been talking about, like, my adventures with observing.
Yeah. And,
but, like, there have been a lot of cool developments from other telescopes, like the JWST, that I thought we should maybe talk about, because everyone else seems to be talking about this kind of thing. So
that makes sense. I guess, like, a very quick recap then is because last season we had Ori Fox, who is a scientist who's been working with James Webb, on the pod. And then, yeah, that just launched. And now, well, during last summer, I guess it had first light and we had a lot of these nice images coming out. So, yes, yeah, it's working.
Exactly. And it's working really well. So, like, one of the newer images that's come out is Pandora's cluster, which is one of the latest deep field images that's come from JWST. So a deep field image is basically a snapshot of a part of the night sky which contains a lot of galaxies from the early universe. One of the interesting things about Pandora's cluster is it's a cluster of galaxies that's so dense that it gravitationally lenses.
Yes, okay,
a lot of a lot of other galaxies that are further behind it.
Yes, so even older galaxies.
Yeah, really older galaxies. So we've sort of never been able to see these types of galaxies in such great detail before. So there are 50,000 sources of light coming from this image. Yeah, so the image detail and quality that has come from JWST is just not possible to do anywhere else. And so it's a lot of the quotes that come from the press releases are just, I can't believe what I'm seeing. I just had to stare at this image. So like, there's these scientists who try not to be befuddled by the universe sometimes and really try to explain it are getting baffled by what JWST can do.
And that's nice.
A couple other things. So a team has also provided an in-depth inventory of the deepest, coldest ice measurements in space. So, like,
so it can really pick up, like, emission from cold things.
Yes, really cold things. And, like, the colder you get, usually the dimmer things are in space. And so JWST is able to go a layer deeper that we've never been able to go before. One thing a bit more closer to home for me is JWST confirmed its first planet.
Yes, and this is important, right?
Yes.
It confirms.
It didn't detect it. It confirmed it. So LHS-475b.
Oh, lovely name.
Yeah. It's a planet almost the exact same size of Earth. So it was already detected by the TESS satellite, which detects exoplanets. But TESS doesn't get to confirm planets exist. It gets, like, one signal and says, hey, there's a planet right here and we need someone to follow it up. And so JWST was the one that did that. It picked a target that was much more harder to observe than maybe other telescopes can do and basically passed with flying colors, without a doubt, prove that this planet existed.
Sure. But you may correct me here, but as I've understood it, like, James Webb's expertise or the telescope's expertise is not to really look for exoplanet, right?
No, exactly. Yeah. So it's looking for an exoplanet with JWST is like taking a Ferrari to go grocery shopping.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not, you can take it to go grocery shopping, but that's not what it's built for.
Sure.
And so JWST instead is much better at characterizing a planet or even looking at it in much greater detail. That was a thing that this team actually did. They tried to look for an atmosphere on this planet. It was still not strong enough in signal, but it was, they were able to rule out a few things, like having a methane-dominated atmosphere, which is what Titan has on our the moon
Saturn,
of Saturn.
Yeah.
The one of Saturn's moons, exactly. So JWST is basically been able to do a lot of cool things. I think one of the really interesting things about JWST is that it isn't doing anything new, per se. What's exciting about it is it's doing groundbreaking work at a level of detail that was impossible to do before.
So you mean like we have seen older galaxies before, we're just seeing them clearer more now. And we have seen exoplanets before, but we can see them better, I guess. Yeah.
And then now, so we know that they were there, but the detail that JWST is providing for us is unlocking stories that we were never able to explain before. So the first telescope that really was able to see galaxies at a distance was Hubble.
Yeah, and Hubble is, well, still up and running, right?
For now.
For now, okay.
Yeah. So NASA has sadly said it's not going to finance any more servicing missions up to Hubble.
And sure, yeah.
Its orbit's also decaying.
Yeah, because it's in orbit around Earth, right?
Yeah.
And that will slowly, well, lose height.
Yeah, and then fall back and burn up in Earth's atmosphere. So NASA basically said, look, you've been going for 30 years.
Mm.
You've done a great job. Mm. But we now have JWST and the technology is moving along. So maybe it's time to go to sleep. You've done a great job. Thing is, SpaceX has come along and said, hey, wait a minute. What if we service or we push the satellite up into space and keep it orbiting for a little bit longer?
Mm.
Could we do that?
Mm.
And NASA says, sure, but we won't pay for it. So,
So interesting.
This is sort of becoming an experiment. SpaceX now gets a chance to test its ability on pushing satellite telescopes into space, which is never done on a satellite which was going to deorbit anyway.
Sure.
So if they're successful, we'll get a few more years of Hubble, which it is still quite useful and people want to use. And if not, we'll learn something anyway. So it's been a great telescope to have. And it was the first thing to do this new stuff.
Mm.
But now JWST is moving forward.
No, and I think also, because I'm thinking back to that interview I had with Ori Fox, which I encourage anyone who hasn't listened to it to go back and listen to it. And he really said that James Webb Space Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope, they're complementary to each other.
Yeah.
Like, so I think anything you can do to have Hubble observe for longer, it's all good. So that's good news.
Yeah,
if it works.
If it works, yeah.
But I guess one thing that is nice with telescopes here on the ground is that you can update them very easily.
Yeah, exactly. So
very biased. But also, I guess from my months at ESO, I'm also very sort of like, oh, ground-based telescopes, they're cheaper and you can build them bigger and you can maintain them and upgrade them.
And you can visit them on your holiday if you're really keen. Well, maybe not all of them, but...
No, well, I wouldn't go on a holiday in Atacama Desert.
But. Yeah, fair enough. Well, then there is one big telescope that's being built.
Mm.
It's extremely large.
Yes.
You know a bit more about that, actually. Maybe you want to fill me in a bit.
Oh, I guess, yes. So the ELT is really being built right now. It's super cool. So one of my tasks at ESO was to sort of check the webcams every morning to see that they're up and running. And that means that like the webcams that was monitoring the construction of the ELT was like part of my task to look at. So I could really see it being from when I arrived, like just the foundations to now with having like the dome walls are being put up. So that's really cool. It will be like this new generation telescope, like 39 meter. You went to the Keck, you said, which is like 10. And that's like the big ones we have now.
Yeah,
so
right.
This is like really another big leap. And you'll be able to also, catch a lot of photons with that. So also get very, very sharp things. It will also characterize exoplanets, look for galaxies. It will do many different cool things. For now, it's like the timing of it is a bit pushed, partly because, well, we've had a pandemic and there's also a lot of, issues with transport chains and because of the war, for instance.
Right,
so there's a lot of issues there, but it's due to come online end of this decade. So
I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's one, I'll call him a hero that hadn't had their song sung, and that's the Vera Rubin telescope.
Yes.
So this telescope's a 8.2 meter telescope, so it's about the same size of the VLT.
Mm.
The thing about this telescope, it's a bit special. Instead of making a bigger telescope, they've specialized it to observe as many stars or targets as they can in one shot. This telescope's going to be able to survey the entire sky in just three nights.
Yeah.
Which is insane. Like, imagine.
That is really crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And most telescopes are more or less designed to look at one target for a very long period of time. So to go from one target to the entire night sky at a really a good amount of detail is impressive.
Mm.
So I think.
Nice.
Yeah, things are looking pretty good for telescopes at the moment. I think.
Really?
Yeah.
And I think just like shout out here to Vera Rubin in a way. So we talked with Ruth Petken last week and she is looking for dark matter. And Vera Rubin as one of the astronomers actually indirectly discovered that dark matter actually exists out there. So
yeah, right. So
tying the knot a bit.
Yeah, comes full circle.
But yeah, who do we have on for this week?
We have Judith Court, who is an observer who works with us here at London Observatory. She's just started her job and we've pulled her into our podcast studio to find out more about her.
Let's hear more about Judith.
Yeah. And now I'd like to welcome to the mic Judith Court. Hey Judith, how are you going?
Hi Nick, thanks for inviting me and for letting me speak in here.
It's our absolute pleasure. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Yes, of course. I'm Judith, I'm a German researcher. Actually, I'm an exoplanetary researcher.
Oh, cool. Like me.
Oh, you too?
Yes.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, I guess we're still getting to know each other around the office. So yeah, I look at atmospheres of exoplanets. Well, more about you. So, how did you get into exoplanets?
Oh, this is a very good question. Interesting. Because for me, it was not quite straightforward, as some people maybe think this is, as you say, oh, I'm a researcher. Because I started actually as a meteorologist.
Oh, wow. Or
trying to be a meteorologist, let's say it like this.
Okay. What made you swap to exoplanets?
The learning cloud names. I was very bad in learning these all different names of clouds and different kind of things and weather forecasts. My weather forecast was really, really bad, honestly. I couldn't, if you see, we need to explain. So, okay, this is Europe and over from east, from west, from this coming, these clouds are or this high profile. Mm-hmm. And I was saying from right, left, bottom, top.
Oh, okay.
I think, okay, this is not very professional weather forecast, and so okay, yeah, but this is the best I could do. And then I said, okay, maybe this is not where I will end up.
Mm-hmm.
Not like being in a TV show and think, oh, this is the weather forecast, from bottom we have clouds. So yeah, and then I said, okay, maybe climate change.
Okay, yeah.
And this is still I haven't ended up there, but this is still one of my private home research things.
Okay.
So I'm still kind of interested in this and following everything up, but I'm not doing it for work.
Yeah, okay, so it's more for yourself. I had a very similar experience, actually. So I started studying physics before I moved into astronomy, and it was the same thing, like learning all these differential equations and these, like, you sort of feel sometimes bamboozled. And then for me, finding astronomy was a really nice fit because all of a sudden everything started making sense and it started becoming fun. Was that something that you experienced as well?
Yes, exactly. No, because after the meteorology thing,
yeah,
I was like, hey, okay, there's also geophysics. Another thing I studied was geophysics.
Oh, okay.
But this was a geophysics of the Earth. So like electrons in the ground and measuring the surface profile and underground to actually if they're holes, if they're canals, and this kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also very fun. I mean, it was more outdoor. So you could go to field work. You were spending whole days out. So that's actually what I thought.
Mm.
But in the end, I also sat up in front of a computer and simulating things and doing this. And then when I went to field work, it was I couldn't carry the instruments.
Oh.
They were too heavy.
Oh, that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, so then I had the question to ask myself, does it really make sense to stay here if you always need someone else carrying the instruments to have the big guys next to you? Okay, can you do this? Can you do this? And it's like, nope.
Oh.
And by the end, we had another field in our university. I studied in the University of Cologne.
Yep.
This was geophysics of the space.
Uh-huh, okay.
So I thought, oh, okay, this is another thing where you can go to. Let's try this now out. And so I went to actually study Titan.
Okay.
And this is how I ended up then in the astronomy world. Like,
okay, so Titan being one of Saturn's moons?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Like, I've never really studied any of the solar system planets myself. Do you find it very exciting, like, looking at those ones? Or do you think exoplanets are more interesting?
Of course, exoplanets are more interesting because we don't know what we find. So this is still a new kind of new research field. I know, I mean, the solar system, you know, already for centuries,
mm-hmm.
and the people are still interested in them already, but now they are going out and out and out, and we are detecting something completely new. It was each new data set coming out. We have new problems. I think, oh, we thought we solved this already. And then, oh, no. Yep. We know better. And no, I think this is also then why Exoplanet catches me so far. And yeah, and why I'm also still staying there now for so long time since my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And also the field is still so quickly growing. It's really expanding. I mean, we had I started my when I was a bachelor student was the Corot mission, then we came the Kepler mission, the TESS mission, and soon coming Plato and Ariel. So it's all space-based missions to actually characterize or detect exoplanets from the space.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such amazing that there's so much effort put in these topics. So people are really interested in this. And the thing is also the thing to find other worlds, to see actually how unique we are and this kind of things. So this is also why actually the big public is quite interested in this.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of sexy research when you get out, hey, I'm doing exoplanetary research. And people, oh, yes, cool. Do you find, what is it around? And like for me, like other kind of astronomy are not that much interest, not to call it not interesting, but it's difficult to sell.
Yeah.
To get a selling point on planets and say, okay, we want to find the other second world, we want to find a second Earth. This is clear. People can understand because they know our Earth, and it's easy to say, of course, are we so selfish to say that we are completely unique in the universe, or is there something else outside? So
yeah. You mentioned Corot. Could you remind me what exactly that is?
Yes, of course. Yeah, Corot is kind of interesting because it was actually the first space-based mission to detect exoplanets.
Oh, wow.
So it was not Kepler who started, was doing this. It was actually Corot, and Corot was a lad, French lad. So it was an ESA mission. So ESA was started to explore exoplanets before NASA.
Wow.
Also, Corot detected the first rocky planet. It was Corot 7b.
Okay. I think it's a very natural goal for exoplanet scientists to search for Earth, and it's also a very hard objective to achieve because, well, how about you explain to us how difficult seeing an Earth would be? Is that when do you expect us to find a second Earth?
Hopefully soon.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking for this for decades now, but I mean the next mission, the Plato mission. Will is actually designed to find the second Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's also Earth 2.0. And but even then, if you want to find another planet like the Earth, which has an orbital period of a year, so then we need a long time actually in space to have data. So we would detect our Earth around the sun if we would have 3 years of continuously data.
Right, okay. So then if we backtrack a little bit to detecting exoplanets themselves, because you mentioned a bunch of planetary search missions, such as the Corot mission and TESS. How exactly do all of those missions work in detecting exoplanets?
So they all rely on the method called the transit method.
Mm-hmm.
This is just that we observe a bunch of stars with a telescope. And so we collect actually the light, so the photons coming to the telescope. And then we actually monitor them over a long time. And we are looking for eventually the drops in the brightness. So when the brightness decreases, then the brightness decreases because something is actually passing in front of the star, in front of the telescope line of sight.
Okay.
So between the telescope and the star, then something is passing in front. And then what we actually observe then is a drop in the brightness. So this is how all these missions so far detected exoplanets. So this is actually, like, we call this when this event like a transiting. Yeah. We have also transit in the solar system. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And and then how we actually do this. So each transit is done and we detect then one drop in the brightness. And then we continue monitoring. And then suddenly we detect a second drop in the brightness. And then we see, okay, maybe it's produced by the same planet. So then we can calculate the time between the two drops and the brightnesses. And then we say, okay, this can be maybe the period of these and these days, like the days in between.
Right.
But also then we can already see, okay, are the dips, the drops and the brightness decrease the same? So do they have the same depth or not? So for example, if it's a big, big planet passing in front of the star, then we have a very deep decrease in brightness. And then in a small planet, of course, then passes in front of the star, the brightness doesn't increase so much. So we can already distinguish a little bit. And then if we see two dips in the brightness, we can actually see, then we detect.
So would that be a way to tell the difference between two planets that may be transiting? So how do you, say you see one transit event occur and then you see another occur, you could say that it's the same planet causing that transit event, or it could be two different planets. So is it just the drop in brightness that we can, bigger planet blocks out more light, or is there another way we can also see if there is another planet or if it's just the one planet orbiting the system?
So this really depends on how much time we have on the telescope. Yep. So if we continue, then we can see maybe another, we just continue and then we see the next dips, then we are more for sure. For example, the golden rule is 2 to 3 dips and transits we need to actually be sure that this is the same period. And then we say, okay, this is produced by the same planet.
Right, okay.
But then of course, what you said now was really 100% correct. The different shapes and forms of these transit already say us, okay, if it's from the same event or not, if they actually agree with each other. This is what we drew from the space. We have also events that's called like single transit events. This is when we only observed one of the transits. And then you can do some mathematical calculations and you can actually estimate a rough period already, depending on on the transit duration, how long actually the planet takes in front of the star. Then you do some nice math and then you can say, okay, the period is roughly like this. And what some research do, they just get some other telescope time of a lot of ground-based telescopes or like the other space-based mission at the moment, like KEOPS. And then they do a follow-up of these known events. And then you can say, okay, I want next Thursday, I want to observe this star. And maybe we can detect then observe another transit.
Okay.
And so this is, space-based missions also always need some ground-based follow-up or like with KEOPS space-based follow-up.
Yep.
But the amount is quite high because also the space-based class is mainly dedicated only to exoplanets, but here on the ground, a lot of facilities are not 100%, the time is not 100% dedicated to exoplanetary research. So you still have to write research proposals and go to competitive calls and convince people from your science to get finally time. And then you hope it's got weather, you have not miscalculated something, and and then finally, maybe you get your data and you see, yes, I observed the transit. So now we can be sure this is the period of the planet is like this and or this. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you don't observe it, then you did, okay, we did maybe something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But also what can happen, for example, and especially now with space-based missions is that the transit we observe is actually not completely on target. So maybe it's actually it's not orbiting the star we sought, but maybe a nearby star. So this is actually only leaking in the light curve. And because the field of view is so big that there are so many stars in the same pixel that we cannot distinguish it. So then we need the follow-up to actually to say, okay, transit is on target, we call it. It's actually on orbiting this star or maybe another star. Mm-hmm. Or maybe sometimes it turns out that event we observe is actually not a planet but another star. So this can happen, and this is, people are not so happy with this, at least from the exoplanetary community.
So then if I have understood this correctly, we wait for the planet to transit and then we wait some time more and then it will transit again and we say that's a completed orbit. Do planets always transit like a clock, like every 30 days we expect to transit, or can that change from time to time?
So actually, it changes.
Okay.
Because it's not 100% constant. So this is, we just assume this is constant. But also we know from our errors that there are a little bit of changes in the year and it varies. But the changes in transit appearances is actually another interesting field, and actually also the field which I worked on for the last years, it's called transit timing variation. And this is exactly the feature that you mean. So we observe a star and a transit for a long time, and we always collect the time of transit appearance when it's exactly in front of the star, and then we calculate the time and the period. And then sometimes we can measure some deviations. And this deviation then can hint that there might be something else in the system. And this other object, actually what it does, it perturbs these transiting planets gravitationally, so they're pulling each other. And so this the effect that we then observe is that the transit comes a little bit earlier or later in time, produced by the gravitational pulling and accelerations. So it's actually acceleration, deceleration mm-hmm. from two bodies on each other's, yep. like pure gravitational force. There's not so much mystery or magic behind, it's just gravitation. Mm. And this can then be used to, for example, detect other systems, other planets in the system, or also to determine the orbital parameters or the mass of the planets to a certain amount. And this is quite interesting because then we only need actually to observe a star to detect a planet, and we don't need any other facility or the other thing, just pure gravitation and drops in brightnesses.
Okay, so then you don't have to spend so much time writing observing proposals and like that. You just get your data and you can work with that.
Exactly.
It sounds quite challenging, actually, to learn to do this all yourself. Have you found this is something that came easy to you, or did you have to really like put blood and sweat into it to sort of get to where you are today?
Honestly, a lot of blood and pressure and uncomfortness was put into this.
Okay.
It was not easy for me to be here today.
Okay.
Because, you have a lot of doing your PhD times, a little bit of question, do you really want to do this? And when you are stuck in the problem, exactly, I was stuck in the problem and then I have to solve it by myself. But also it teaches you how to actually overcome this. So actually I went out of this much stronger.
Yeah.
And the PhD time taught me a lot to do, especially of fighting, not giving up, but also more to the end is, okay, why I'm doing all this? So you have to focus, do I really want to, for example, stay in science? Do I really want to work as a researcher? And in the end, you decide, okay, if you want to go this path, this way, it's okay. But also, for example, afterwards, if you decide after PhD, okay, I can still do the last year. I can submit. I can write a thesis. But then I'm done with this. I don't want to compete with other people. I don't want the pressure anymore. I just want to be happy. Work where I go at 10 o'clock, I'm at work, at 5 o'clock, I'm out, or other times. And after this, I don't need to use my brain. Or before, I don't need to use my brain. I have weekends. Then you do something else. But if you really want to stay in research, it's a little bit, I don't say you need to spend more of your energy to this, because this is also not healthy. You still find the balance.
Yeah.
But it's still that your brain always, at least my brain always thinks, okay, I need to do this. How does this? So even when I'm at home and pretend of not working, my brain doesn't stop. It's still, okay, this and this and this. And so,
It never fully stops, I guess. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people who may not have, who are not in academia don't realize or don't know, is that it's a lot of work. And sometimes we do take our work with us to home and it can be challenging. But would you say that it's worth it? Like, do you find the work fulfilling? And yeah, do you feel the work fulfilling?
I love it.
You love it, yeah.
I love it. I love to use my brain to produce something, to think about them, to think about a topic and to find a solution. I really enjoy doing this. Find something new and just to have new data, to play around, to get new results. For me, this is amazing.
Yeah.
I know not all people understand this. And it's a kind of, let's say, it's the same community. You meet people, people working as a researcher. I think we are all one community and a kind of family. So everyone understands each other from the mindset. So it's easier and you feel home.
Yeah.
And if you then, for example, you are on a holiday, you are a weekend, you're doing your free time. And then people ask, hey, who are you? What are you doing? And then you say, yes, I'm a researcher, I'm working on exoplanetary science. Oh, this is so cool, can you explain me? And then sometimes I think, yes, but not now.
Yeah.
I would love, but I'm out of office. I have also my free time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a little bit where our responsibility to society also starts.
Yeah.
Because we are a researcher. So yes, we have the responsibility to also to share our knowledge because you are researchers. I mean, write papers to share our knowledge. We go to conferences to share and a little bit offer, get to know each other's knowledge and feedback. And this is also when we are home and just some random people ask us, hey, what are you doing? And so you should still take your time to talk to the people and say, yes, I'm doing this and this is my passion behind this, and I decided, and actually what you asked me, how you come there, because also a lot of people are interested in this, and especially the younger generations, they really are interested, and for instance, like, oh, the whole space outside, and we are here, and this is so fascinating, mm-hmm. and especially these people, we should actually talk to, and get even more inspired, so maybe they also decide to stay in science, or go to, at least try it out. And for example, I was when I was doing my PhD, I was still working to actually teach the people in math who had problems. So I went once a week back to my hometown to just educate the people in mathematics and some other questions. Mm. The children were 6, 7, 8, up to 14. So huge variety of ages. And some people like what I'm doing and they were interested in this. So they asked me some questions. And it was also nice to see, especially that a person or a woman, a girl from this small village actually went out in the whole in the huge world and did some cool, nice stuff and is trying to become a doctor. And this, so it was kind of all like a role model a little bit.
Hmm.
I'm just happy to see then that, for example, one of these kids then it was really bad in mathematics by then and just is now studying engineers, this kind of stuff. So it can actually help a little bit also to just sit down with people and take a moment of your time to do this. And this is still the researchers.
Well, you not only tried to be a doctor, you became a doctor and you've clearly earned your stripes, to say, for lack of a better metaphor. So talking about inspiring the next generation, maybe we can finish off with what advice would you give the little girl or the bachelor student who is struggling with mathematics, who really wants to become an astronomer? What would you say to them if their dream is to become an academic and become an astronomer?
Try it. So don't even try it if you want to become something, just try it.
Mm-hmm.
But also if you don't achieve it, because some things, for example, myself, when I wanted to do a field geophysicist and exploring the ground, and I just realized, okay, now these instruments are too heavy, then just find another thing that also fascinates you the same way or even more. So there's always one way, another way, one door opens, one door closes, another door opens. Mm-hmm. So this is really the truth. So don't be stuck also with your vision. I want to become this. I want to do this. If this is nothing for you, you find it out and then change it. But also if you're really passionate for this, just stay there and fight for it. And in the end, it's nice. So it's really worth doing this. At least for me, it was worth doing this.
Great. Well, Judith, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. And I wish you best of luck with your future research.
Thank you, Nick.
This is Cosmic Curiosities. My name is Victor, and at the microphone with me today, I have one of the podcast hosts, Rebecca Forsberg, who, as you may already know, is a PhD student studying the Milky Way.
Hello!
So Rebecca, what cosmic curiosity have you brought with you?
Okay, so this might be quite a bit of a nerdy one, but it's like a big favorite. It's more of a like cool trivia, I'd say, of mine. So have you heard of Erik Holmberg?
Yes, he has a meeting room named after him in the astronomy building, right?
Yeah, but do you know who he was?
Not really.
No, that's fine. So Erik Holmberg did actually his PhD here at Lund Observatory in the late 30s.
Okay.
He used to be the student of Knut Lundmark, who is also has a room named after him here.
A bigger room, but yes.
A bigger room, yes, exactly. But both of them and also Erik Holmberg, they studied other galaxies. So I'd say the concept of other galaxies was sort of brought on in the 20s when Edwin Hubble managed to measure the distances to stars in Andromeda and figured that they're very, very far away. So Andromeda has to be another galaxy.
Right.
And that sort of spiraled into, pun not intended, spiraled into this field of study of studying other galaxies, which Holmberg did.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So before that, we just thought of stars as being stars on the sky.
Yeah, exactly. And that the Milky Way was like the only galaxies, and that what they called nebulas at the time was all sort of either clouds that we know of nebulas today, but also other galaxies that were spiral nebulas, which Andromeda was called before it was called an actual galaxy of itself.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the cool trivia I brought to you today is that Erik Holmberg proved that galaxies can merge.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did he do that?
Yeah, so that this is actually, I guess, the cool thing. So you might today know that we can simulate galaxy mergers, right? You do that in a course.
Yeah, we do it in computational astrophysics.
Exactly. And then, you know, it's quite tricky.
Yes.
Yes.
Requires a lot of code.
It requires a lot of code. And it's what you usually call solving an N body problems, because you have a number amount of bodies in a problem that you need that interacts with each other, and you need to solve this. So what Erik Holmberg did, he didn't have a fancy computer in the late 30s. But what he did is he actually set up 74 light bulbs on a big table.
Okay.
Yes. And light decreases in the same way as gravity does. So that's like the force decreased by the distance squared.
Right.
So he could use light to trace it as gravity.
Right, right, right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So is each light bulb a star then in the galaxy, or?
So it's more like a clump of mass
in
a sense. And I think you also do this, I'm not expert on like galaxy simulations, but I think today also when you simulate galaxies, you don't do each star as an individual star in the code, but you rather do like clump masses of like, this is a mass of, I know, 1,000 solar masses. And he sort of did the same concept that each light bulb was a clump of mass in two galaxies. So his idea was, can two galaxies merge, and can they collide in such a way that they, with tidal forces, stop each other and become one?
Okay.
Because you could see, they could see this on the sky, right? So he, for instance, and other astronomers at the time, they could see nebulas, as they call them, galaxies, that were sort of dancing this cosmic thing together. And the first idea was this was disrupting galaxies, that they were like galaxies going apart. But his idea was, can they actually come together? And right. I guess this isn't, like, for you, this might be like, you know, everyday cup of tea, that galaxies merge, right?
Yeah, sort of, I guess.
Yeah, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but like your thesis here at the Lund Observatory is about how the Milky Way has been affected by other galaxies.
That's the leading theory, I would say, at least. Mm-hmm. So how the Milky Way has been misformed, I guess you could say, as a potentially a consequence of galaxies coming really close to the Milky Way or having merged with the Milky Way is what I'm looking at. But so Holmberg sort of showed that if you have two galaxies going on a collision course, they could form a singular galaxy instead of just two messed up galaxies. Like you have two cars that collide, and then it becomes one singular car.
This is a bit of a, it's good that you bring that up. It's a bit of a misconception with galaxy collisions that we sort of sloppily say. It's more of a merger. It's not a collision as with cars, you know, it's like big crash and it's all a mess afterwards. It's more of like, I would say, a cosmic dance where they're with tidal forces spiral into each other and pull and tear each other apart until they eventually form a unit.
Yeah.
And that will, of course, disrupt them. And yeah, he could show this. What he did was for each, he exchanged each of these light bulbs with a photographic plate. And then that photographic plate was exposed to the light from the other light bulbs. And using that, he could calculate how much light that photographic plate got, or convert it to how much mass is that point or gravity exerted to. And then he could see how, calculate rather, how this point would be affected by the other point and then move towards each other.
Okay.
I'm like, for the listening here, I'm waving with my hands a lot, which isn't useful at all. But really what he saw that these two galaxies eventually formed spirals together and became a clump.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, because that's sort of what the computer does now when we simulate these things.
It is, right?
So yeah. It was just doing that on with pen and paper.
Yeah, exactly. I did that with pen and paper. I can't imagine how much time it must have taken, but quite a bit of time and effort.
And likely no calculator either to help him out.
I don't know, maybe not. No, I guess a lot of pen and paper and not a lot of computer code.
That's hardcore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So that was my sort of trivia.
Okay. But absolutely sure then that the light bulb method isn't the best method to model the galaxy?
Yeah, I would say using a computer is probably a more efficient way of doing it.
All right.
Yeah.
This was the third episode of the third season of The Meridian. It was hosted by Rebecca Forsberg and me, Nicholas Borsato, and our producer, Anna Arnadotti. Our guest today was Judith Court. If you have any comments or questions about The Meridian, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observatory account on Twitter. The theme at the beginning of the show included the voices of Astronomics Ungdom, who attended a research school here at Lund Observatory back in 2021. Make sure you tune into next week's episode, when we will have Mary Dacke, crossing our local meridian, talking about how animals use the night sky to navigate, and some more cosmic curiosities. Thank you for listening.